from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out about an Eitelsorg Museum exhibit that's taking place in New York City.
And food writer Jolene Ketzenberger joins us for a special interview with Food Network's Ted Allen. And then I'll chat with Jim Walker about what's going on at the Big Car Service Center this summer. Plus, there will be our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR.
For the first time, an Eitelsorg Contemporary Art Fellowship exhibition has traveled to the epicenter of American art, New York City. We Are Here, an exhibit designed and curated by the Eitelsorg Museum of American Indians and Western Art, is currently open at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, NMAI, in the George Gustav Hay Center. Sharon Gamble invited curator Jennifer Complo McNutt in to tell us about this coup.
So the fellowship has been your baby through the years, right?
Right, since 1999.
Holy moly. This was
our seventh exhibition. It happens every other year.
What was the intent when it started?
The intent, well, there were several. One, to bring attention to Indianapolis, to bring attention to the Eitelsorg Museum, and to also help Native American artists. And we really saw a gap in the area of Native American contemporary work that was non-traditional, and we took a leap that other museums have not.
How do you account for that gap being there, that void being there?
It's interesting. Native American artists have not enjoyed the same kind of acceptance as Asian American or African American artists. And in some ways, it's kind of like, you know how people like to hire from out of town?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so
it's not invented here must be better.
Yes. So I think some of that was going on, but there was a real concerted effort by Native American contemporary artists themselves to curate their own exhibits, to exhibit together, and so we could see this happening, this movement happening, and to encourage it was just to help lead the way for other museums to become interested in it.
And speaking of other museums, tell me about how this exhibition ended up at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian.
Well, we've been talking with several museums about the idea of traveling selections from the fellowship collection.
Sure.
And that is a big endeavor. And so this was like a baby step. The National Museum of American Indian has really shown some interest in the exhibition and supported it by some of their staff writing for our catalogs or coming and speaking or participating just by coming to support the artists. And so through this relationship that we have on different levels, they were interested in taking the 2011 fellowship and exhibiting it in their New York space at the High Center at One Bowling Green. And so we negotiated with them, which was actually a great negotiation and a great team effort. It was really fun trying to plan getting that exhibition to NMAI. And interestingly enough, a lot of the artists were from the eastern part of the U.S., so it was easy to get all the artists there to celebrate the opening of the exhibit in New York City, too. So,
you know all the stuff that happens backstage, so to speak, for those of us who just visit museums. It's just kind of magical. A touring exhibit comes, and we hear about it for a few weeks or months, and then it's magically there, but it's not that easy.
No, not quite. Because, first of all, you're translating an exhibit from one space to another. So for instance, there are safety issues that have to be addressed. And in one location, you might use stanchions or platforms. In another location, you might have to use a different method. You have to negotiate between collections how to best exhibit the work and how to best care for it at the same time. And so that's probably the biggest part of the negotiation. We, of course, sell our catalog in their gift shop. We did joint programming. In fact, I'm just recently back from New York City, where I did a program in conjunction with the Museum of Art and Design, who opened another contemporary Native American exhibition. And so NMAI, with the fellowship, and the MAD Museum, with Changing Hands, did a joint program.
Smart.
It was very fun. And it was a Monday morning, 11 o'clock, pouring down rain, and we had over 100 people there. And there were a lot of people that knew a lot about Native American contemporary work.
That's so cool.
And same thing when we went to the MAD Museum in the afternoon. It's really exciting. Really great cooperation and programming and logistics of getting the exhibit there. It was all fun.
And amazing visibility for the Idlejorg, yeah. Not just for the individual artist, but for the Idlejorg and for this fellowship program. You're probably going to be flooded with more applications than usual when you open that up in the fall, right?
Actually, we will adjudicate for that mid-August.
Okay.
We've already opened up the applications. As soon as one closes in November, then by January, we're sending out the new applications because we have to put a catalog together, which
right.
takes about a year.
Wow.
So we're back in the thick of it. In fact, this is the harder year than the year we exhibit it, because then you just have to put it up and, you know, interpret some of the things. But now you have to do all the writing and research and all
the
that
logistics.
Kind of, yes.
Yeah. Hey, how many Native American or American Indian museums are there in the world and then in the United States?
Well, that is a good question. There are, I'm going to say 7, but I can't name all of them. We are part of a consortium. There's the Heard Museum in Arizona, of course, National Museum of the American Indian, the Wheelwright Museum, and we're part of a group of directors that get together and talk about different issues. And in fact, we do collective exhibition. There's a National Geographic exhibition that we're all going to do at the same time coming up.
When is that?
You asked me too fast, but
I'm sorry.
I believe that is after Quest for the West. And Quest for the West is the opening weekend, I think, is September 8th and 9th, and that's about a month running. So go to idlejorg.org and check out what our exhibition schedule is, because I believe that it's opening probably mid-October, right around the time you're going to see Jingle Rails.
Yeah, well, that'll make everybody feel cooler.
Yeah.
The thought of Jingle Rails.
Really.
So do you have any pieces that changed dramatically from the setting they were in at their, I refer to the Idlejorg as their home space,
uh-huh.
and then going out to New York, was there anything that you, after you installed it, you said, that's something I hadn't noticed in its previous setting?
Well, I want to say the canoe, but it didn't really change the way the paper canoe by Bonnie Devine, who is a First Nations or Canadian Indigenous artist, was done in paper. So it's black and white,
mm-hmm.
and it's her thesis on the use of uranium or the mining of uranium on her reserve and all the horrible things that it did to the landscape.
Hmm.
And they still go back there and dance on the reserve, but after 3 days, the bottoms of their moccasins are worn out. So it's
wow.
a very dramatic situation, but there is still a strong connection to that land. That canoe changed a little bit in its interpretation at the National Museum of the American Indian. But what happened more than anything is our space is a big open space.
Right.
And I like to think of the exhibit as one exhibit and how things relate to each other.
Right.
In the National Museum space, what happens is they have kind of an H space,
okay.
so it's shaped in this form of an H,
mm-hmm.
and so each artist had their own individual space, so in a way you could meditate on them individually in a way that maybe you didn't at the Idlejorg. There might have been more comparisons between pieces at the Idle Jork.
Sure.
And interestingly, there were two artists that worked primarily in black and white, mm-hmm. and three artists that worked in moving pictures or color.
Really?
Yeah, and it was really interesting to compare and contrast and to compare similarities and how they differed in moving images. One was more animated, one was more like a documentary. It was really interesting comparisons. But, you know, once you get an exhibit in a different space, you're reinterpreting the exhibit.
Sure, it changes the way people experience the context.
Exactly.
Did you have to change any of your signage?
They took our interpretive labels and, not really. I mean, we might have tweaked some of the intro to include why it was at the National Museum of the American Indian and, a little bit more about the beginning of the fellowship, because some of our patrons know a little bit more than, somebody coming from New York City without any background in what we're doing. But, it was a pretty easy transition because both institutions are very professional. Both wanted the same thing, for the exhibit to look the best that it could,
sure.
to present the artists in their best light and to give them, most of them have exhibited in New York City in one form or another, but this was probably for most of them, their biggest presence, the most amount of pieces that they had in New York City at one time. So it was fun. It was good.
What's your ideal outcome of having this exhibition in New York?
Interestingly, our ideal outcome is to make people familiar with Native American contemporary work and to help get them into the mainstream. That's always been our goal. And what we're doing locally to do that is we're partnering with different institutions like IMOCA, and they are going to do a contemporary Native American exhibition coming up in December.
Really? So
we've just helped them identify some artists, and then we're kind of working together to make that happen.
You're taking over the world.
You betcha. That's our goal.
What is the next step for this exhibit? Will the art all go back to the artists after the exhibit closes in September?
Well, we purchased a lot of pieces for the permanent collection, and I'll just remind people that some people consider that the best collection of Native American contemporary work in the world. Certainly, we are one of, if not the most active collection institution doing that right now, and that makes for some really interesting exhibitions up in our contemporary permanent space. So it's not just the fellowship, it's what we're doing all year round that is interesting. And twice a year, we change that exhibit out pretty dramatically. So you can see a lot of the previous fellowship pieces. A few of the pieces from one of the artists is going to be up in the fall in the Contemporary Gallery. So there's an opportunity to see what comes of the fellowship any time of the year.
You're running out of storage space yet?
Well, if you ask collections, we're running out of storage space for everything at all times. But if you ask me, no.
Spoken like the curator you are, girl.
Sharon Gamble with the Idle Jorg's Jennifer Compla McNutt. You can see We Are Here, an exhibit designed and curated by the Idle Jorg Museum at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian through September 23rd, 2012, in New York City.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Here at The Art of the Matter, we believe the culinary arts are just as important as all the other arts, in fact, maybe more so. And that's why for this week we have a special guest interviewer, Jolene Ketzenberger, the food writer for the Indianapolis Star. She's joining us because she recently got to speak with Ted Allen, the Food Network host, two-time James Beard Award winner, cookbook author, and Carmel High School alumni.
This is Jolene Ketzenberger, food writer for the Indianapolis Star. I'm in the studio at WFYI 90.1 with Ted Allen, Food Network host, James Beard Award winner, cookbook author, and Carmel High School alumni. Hi, Ted. It's great to see you.
Hey, great to see you, Jolene. That's two-time James Beard Award winner.
Two-time James Beard Award. So first of all, congratulations on the James Beard Foundation Awards. You took home 2-1 for Best Studio Show for Chopped. And then for the best media personality for you, what was that like?
That was pretty surprising. That was pretty exciting. We, you know, for the host prize, I was up against Ina Garten and Sarah Moulton.
Oh, my gosh.
Who are two heroes of mine. And just to be mentioned in the same breath is such an honor. And then on the show side, we were up against Ming Tsai and Jacques Pepin. Well, you know, no competition there. It was a thrill. You know, someone asked me yesterday, how does it feel to beat those guys? And I don't feel like we did. I think it's a matter of what's going on in the culture. And
right.
Chopped is fairly fresh and new and fast and different. And I think that's what the judges must have been thinking about. Or else the checks that I wrote to them evidently cleared.
Well, it's your charming personality. So tell us a little bit about Chopped and what makes it fresh and new.
So Chopped is basically a culinary game show on Food Network. It airs Tuesday nights at 10 Eastern, and it's an hour-long show. We start off with four chefs. There are three rounds, appetizer, entree, and dessert. With each round, the chefs are presented with a sadistically cruel basket of ingredients that they must use to make their dish, and we hope that they will focus on those mystery ingredients and elevate them and somehow make them sing together. And with each course, one, the least popular dish that chef is eliminated until we get to the dessert round, and whoever wins that round gets $10,000.
Now, what about, tell me a little bit about Chopped All-Stars. That's been getting, that we've got great ratings. It was very exciting. Who was on that?
Chopped All-Stars is a special five-part series in which we bring in, first we turn the table on our own judges and make them compete.
Exactly.
For one of the four slots in the finale. The winner of that competition was Marcus Samuelson. And then we had three other episodes, one of which had veterans of the Next Food Network star, the very unpopular Penny Davidi.
Oh, she was very unpopular.
And she remains unpopular. And
we could tell.
She wasn't very popular with the judges because she was the second one kicked off. Michael Simon, Iron Chef,
yes,
was the first one kicked off.
Oh, we felt so bad.
I almost, but he left a mystery ingredient off his plate. I almost think he threw the round so he could go play golf or something.
Or not compete with Marcus Samuelson, right?
Which you don't want to do. Trust me. Marcus Samuelson is the most gentle, intelligent, kind person you'll ever meet, unless you're cooking against him, in which case he turns into a monster.
Well, that's who my family was rooting for. So it was very exciting for us to watch.
That was.
Now, what did you do? Did you get together and watch the finale of that one?
Yes, we did. Actually, Marcus hosted us at his restaurant in Harlem, Red Rooster. Which is a great place and sort of the vanguard of the Harlem Renaissance. And if you go to his corner, all around him, he's right a block away from the legendary Linux Lounge. And then there are new restaurants opening all around him. He's created this economic juggernaut on this iconic corner of, I think it's Lenox and 125th Street, stone's throw from the Apollo Theater. Let's see who came. Amanda Freitag came. Mark Murphy, coincidentally, one of the performers from LCD Sound System was there. Great band. And a whole crowd of family and friends, and we watched and cheered, and it was, and we ate yard bird, which is what Marcus calls his fried chicken.
Well, you knew you'd get good food.
We did get good food, and we had a ball.
So tell me a little bit about the book. There, you know, there's been a lot of talk lately about celebrity chefs getting a little help writing their cookbooks. But so how'd that work out for you?
I know what story you're talking about. So the food writer Julia Moskin wrote a story
right.
in the New York Times dining section about celebrities and celebrity chefs using ghostwriters to write their cookbooks for them. And it was it kind of created quite a flurry.
Oh, Gwyneth Paltrow was what took offense at that, I believe.
Indeed. And, first of all, let me say that I found the story very strange because I am a writer. And,
yes.
I am paid.
That's your profession.
I'm paid to write. And as those of us who are writers know, the business of writing is lousy right now. So for anybody to write a story complaining about the fact that Bobby Flay is paying them $50,000 to write something for them, it's hard for me to understand. But there is an understandable current of resentment among food writers who are brought in to do these writing jobs where they ghostwrite a book
right.
For somebody who's famous. Because in large part, I think probably because it's very hard to get a book deal these days unless you're a celebrity.
Right.
And I often feel kind of bad. I have several friends who are very talented chefs and writers who can't get a deal because they're not lucky enough to be on Food Network. Well, I am lucky enough, and I'm not going to turn down the opportunity. I, however, did not use a ghostwriter.
Well, I didn't think you did.
I wrote every stinking word of this book. Every stinking dish, by the way, which was not very smart. I could have hired someone to help me with that. But anyway, the book is called In My Kitchen, and I really had two basic goals with it. The first is to sort of, well, maybe three.
Yeah.
The first is to try to inspire people to think about the act of cooking as pleasure, as joy. And, you know, a lot of people, if they have the day off, they'll go play golf or they'll go kayaking or play baseball or whatever. What I do is I crank up the stereo in my kitchen. I fire up the stove. I open a bottle of wine. I call my friends over and we just cook all blessed day.
Oh, that sounds great.
I can't think of anything I would rather do. Now, that's you have to have the luxury of time. And if you have 17 children, you know, that's hard to do. But it's what I choose to do rather than so many other things. I think of cooking as a joy. When you're in a hurry and you're under pressure and you're short on funds, it's less fun. So I'm talking about not the Tuesday night scramble
exactly
to get the kids quiet, but a day when you can really just kick back and learn new things and have some adventures in the kitchen.
Well, now, you mentioned fire up the stove and get going. Tell me a little bit about that stove. I want your stove, right?
You can't have it.
So you've been remodeling for quite a while, but it's done?
Yes, we finished finally after 5 years. We took a couple years off, so we didn't go totally insane. We live in an 1879 brownstone.
Oh, my goodness.
In Brooklyn, and they're hard to renovate.
Yes, I bet.
We wanted to restore the original detail, but also add central air. It's very tricky in a Victorian. But we managed. I do a lot of work with the Viking Range Corporation, which enables me to get sweet deals on their products. So I have a six-burner.
Oh, six burners.
A six-burner range with a grill and a double oven. You know, Mark Bittman, who I just saw the other day at the Today Show, the author of the classic cookbook, How to Cook Everything, and a very prolific writer, Mark cooked that entire book on a tiny little crummy gas range in Manhattan with 2 feet of counter space.
Right.
So you don't need fancy equipment. But it sure is fun, and it's just like, you know, I liken that stove to a BMW. And just last night I was cooking, and I kind of overcrowded the pan a little bit and needed the heat to crank up quickly. It's just like stepping on the gas in a BMW. It's nice.
So you can crank up that heat.
Absolutely.
Well, now, you have talked a lot about learning from Chopped. Talk a little bit about that and, you know, the things you've picked up along the way.
I have the great pleasure of standing there for 12 hours a day with some of the best chefs in the world, and people like Alex Guarnaschelli and Scott Conant and Chris Santos. And then we have guest judges come in,
right,
too. Susan Feniger, Mark Bittman was a guest judge for us. And you can't really do that without learning. And I now know exactly how to cook pasta. I've learned so much about so many different foods. I mean, I could give you a few tips on pasta.
Yeah, well, do,
from
please.
From the master himself, Scott Conant. You know, recipes always say to generously, you have to salt the water that you cook pasta in, but nobody understands how much, and recipes never tell you how much. First of all, you get the water boiling, then you put the salt in, because salt slows the boiling process. And then stick a spoon in that water and taste it. It should taste about as salty as chicken soup.
Really?
Yes.
Salty? Then people undersalt.
Very salty. The water needs to be very salty because you're seasoning the pasta. You're getting salt into that pasta, and it won't work if you put a teaspoon of salt in 5 gallons of water. It's not going to work. So that's step one.
Okay.
But I love that tip because I don't know how big your pot is, but I can tell anybody, no matter how big it is, one of the most important principles of cooking, taste as you go.
Now, you have said that, and you say that over and over on the show.
Yeah, and people still don't do it.
Oh, my goodness.
Home cooks never do it. Home cooks look at a recipe, and they follow it exactly, and then if it comes out, they think the recipe was good, and otherwise they don't. And, you know, you really need to taste as you go, especially when you're developing a soup or a chili or anything that's long cooked, a tomato sauce. Okay, so you've salted your water generously.
Yes.
Cook the pasta until about 2 minutes less than it's supposed to be cooked. And it should still be a little bit crunchy. And then pull it out of that hot water.
Okay.
Over on your stove, your sauce is gently simmering already in another pot.
I've got that going.
And you add the pasta to the sauce, and you finish cooking the pasta in that. By the way, you did not rinse that pasta.
I did not. Of course
you did not.
But
you
never. That is a very common fallacy, right?
Right. It is absolutely wrong to ever. You never rinse pasta. You do not do it. And the reason why is you want the starch on the outside of that noodle to be there. The starch allows the sauce to cling to the noodle, which is what you want.
Right.
And then when you finish those noodles in the sauce, that flavor is permeating the noodles. Mm-hmm. So you finish it in the sauce until it's just al dente. You know that it's al dente because you're tasting it as you go.
As you go, right.
You don't want any crunch there. But you don't want it to be soft and flabby. Now, I'm sorry, that was kind of a rant.
But a very, very valid rant.
Well, yeah, and I just think that, you know, I learned that from Scott Conant, listening to him thunder with outrage at one chef after another who made their pasta wrong.
Now, you studied journalism, right?
I did, yes.
And you're a writer, so you're not a trained chef?
Correct.
Right? Would you ever want to do that? You want to, like, put yourself through
Absolutely.
Culinary school? You would?
Absolutely. And I would love to go to school. And Barry and I last night were talking about our fantasy for it, which is to go to Italy for a month or two and study culinary there while he fools around in museums or whatever.
That's right.
I would love to do it. But I will say, the training that I'm getting from these judges and from watching these chefs exactly. compete is so helpful. You got to know what you're capable of within 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And if we give you pork shoulder, which is a very tough cut, very hard to break down, what you really need to be doing is either tenderizing it with a mallet and making like a scallopini kind of an idea, or grinding it, because you can't roast a pork shoulder in 20 minutes. It just doesn't happen.
Jolene Ketzenberger, food writer for the Indianapolis Star, joining us as a guest interviewer with Ted Allen, Food Network host, two-time James Beard Award winner, cookbook author, and Carmel High School alumni. Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
You know what this summer is reminding me of?
What's that?
One of my favorite Cole Porter songs.
It's too darn hot.
Yeah, well, whichever version you pick that, it is. It is. But anyway, so I've got that in my mind right now as I'm thinking of other things to do that can maybe help us cool off, or at least they're cool to do. For this weekend calendar week all, what'll we do?
Fan ourselves. That's what we'll do.
So what do you got going on?
Well, here's something that that will certainly be a cool thing to do. Even though it's outdoors, it's a really cool thing. The Middle Eastern Festival, which is every year I look forward to, it is this Friday night. If you're listening to us on Friday, it goes till 11 o'clock. On Saturday, it goes from noon to 4. So if you're listening on Saturday, you missed it. Put it on your calendar for next year. But it is it's a fabulous cultural festival, great things to eat and drink. You can watch dancing or participate in dancing. You can tour the Greek Orthodox Church, that's St. George Orthodox Christian Church, at 4020 North Sherman Drive. And you can get more info about all of this at stgindy.org/festival. So that's short for St. George, stgindy.org/festival, going on this weekend. Yummy.
Very cool. Hey, something else that celebrates art and cuisine is a World of African Art and Cuisine that is taking place this weekend at IPS's Crispus Attucks School. They have a museum there as well. And this weekend, Saturday until 8 p.m. and then Sunday noon until 5, they are showing off their incredible West African art collection, as well as having a West African and Caribbean cuisine sampling and dance and drum ensembles and a whole bunch of other cool activities going on at Crispus Attucks School pretty much all day Saturday and Sunday, till 8 on Saturday and 5 on Sunday.
Excellent. Hey, if you like kind of rock-tinged country, you might be a fan of Leanne Rimes, who's coming to the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. This coming Friday, that's July 27th at 8 o'clock, she has been, boy, it's hard to imagine, but she first burst on the scene when she was just 14 years old, and she has one of those Celine Dion kind of voices with a 7-octave range. Crazy, crazy talented woman. TheCenterPresents.org, Leanne Rimes, next Friday, that's the 27th, 8 o'clock.
Very cool. Hey, coming up on Sunday, Young Actors Theater is having an event in the park. They usually do a lot of things at the Athenaeum, but they're having an event at the McAllister Center for the Performing Arts at Garfield Park Sunday from 4 to 8 p.m. They are having live entertainment from the band Jump Cats, as well as a whole bunch of performances.
Jump Cats!
Performances by Young Actors Theater alumni, silent auction, door prizes, food, beverages, all types of stuff like that. It is a fundraiser for Young Actors Theater, which is a great organization that works with hundreds, literally hundreds of kids around the area with theater classes each and every year. Definitely worth checking out. And so again, this event is at Garfield from 4 to 8 on Sunday.
So, do you and Elizabeth ever dance?
Well, you know, at home sometimes with our cats.
With your cats.
Let's be Speaking of jump cats, yeah.
Dancing Cats and Neglected Murderesses. Remember the Edward Gorey book?
Oh, yeah, that's a great title.
That's a long time ago. Anyway, so here's something kind of fun. At the Museum Nights on the Canal, this is part of the Indiana Historical Society summer programming, you can not only hear music and see demonstrations, but you can get dance lessons next Thursday. That's July 26th at 5 and 6. So you have to sneak out of work a little bit early, maybe. You can see a demonstration and get a lesson, and then you can dance at 7. What kind of dance? Well, on the 26th, it's the Charleston. Woohoo. Then on Thursday, August 2nd, it's the Argentine Tango. Again, at 5 and 6, demonstration and lesson. At 7 o'clock, a dance. And then on Thursday, August 9th, Foxtrot. 5 and 6, demonstration and lesson. And 7 o'clock, dance.
Cool.
So, yeah, it's a lot
very
of fun. And remember,
great.
They're doing their free Thursday night, so you can pop in and see one of the You Are There exhibits or something else cool inside the Indiana History Center.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Hey, so this weekend is the Indianapolis International Film Festival kicks off. In fact, it goes this weekend through July 29th. And during the film festival, there will be over 110 films you can choose from.
Whoa.
From across the country and around the world, and a whole bunch of parties and panels and conversations. It's just a film lover's extravaganza. So,
very, in air conditioning, might I add.
In air conditioning, which is great. Very fun to start. And to check out, you can watch sort of a preview clip reel on their website. You can get more information at indiefilmfest.org, where the whole schedule is. You can figure out if you want to buy individual tickets or one of the passes to go see a bunch of the films. Definitely worth checking out. Always very fun. Indies International Film Fest. Again, indiefilmfest.org.
Fabulous. You know, whenever I have a question and I'm not sure where to start, I think of the library.
It's a good place to go.
It is a great place to go. And you'll hear more about this in the future, because I'm going to have the library CEO, Jackie Needis, on for a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But in the short term, if you have an ebook or you're thinking about getting an ebook for yourself or for a friend or family member, and you know there's a lot of choices out there and you're not sure what you want to do, the library has established a mobile ebook tinker station. It's kind of like a petting zoo. You get to play with the different ebooks and talk to librarians and other experts who can help you figure out which one is for you, depending on what sort of things you think you might download onto it. This Sunday, the 22nd, you can go to an ebook tinker station at 2 o'clock. You have two choices this Sunday, Central Library or the Southport branch. And there's lots of other choices. Virtually 5 or 6 days a week, you can visit another ebook tinker station. And you can go to the library's website and navigate through and find out where you can do that. You can find one near you.
Very cool. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Hey, something going on in Fishers worth checking out. At the Fishers Arts Council is having an event called Art in Town Hall Initiative. And in fact, it opened this weekend with an exhibition by art educator and artist Barbara Andrews. And the show is titled Reflections of the Midwest. And it is free and open to the public. And you can check this out over the next couple weeks at the Fishers Town Hall. Sounds like a great new initiative that they have to feature the work of local artists up there. And Barbara Andrews is a great person to kick this off with, because she has been awarded Best of Show as a teaching artist and received the honorable title of Indiana Art Educator of the Year in the past for her work at New Palestine High School. So go check out her artwork.
Excellent. Hey, final chance to see the new production of Cabaret, which I got to see last weekend.
Sounds very good.
Oh, it's pretty sexy, spicy. So don't take the young children, but be prepared. It is spicy, yeah. Last performance this Saturday night, the 21st. More information at Bob Directs. That's DIREX.com.
Okay, last thing that we have time for is just to give you a heads up. Indiana Wind Symphony is announcing open auditions for all wind instruments coming up on Saturday, August 4th. So if you'd like to get more information, you need to give them a call at 844-4341 for the Indiana Wind Symphony. Sharon, that is it. We are running out of time.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Summer's almost over, but we'll be back next week with more events and items you can do to cool off or just be a cool person on that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Jim Walker is a community artist advocate with the Big Car organization. Travis DiNicola sat down with Jim to find out what Big Car and their service center are up to this summer.
Jim, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always a pleasure.
Hi, Travis.
Happy midsummer to you, a hot one as it is. I really wanted to have you on just to sort of check in with what's going on with service center, because it always seems like there is a lot going on, and I know that there's a lot that's going on right now and coming up in the next couple months, but let's start off with, just for those listeners who are not familiar with what the service center is, what is the service center? Because that's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, thank you. Big Car, the nonprofit organization that I work for, does a variety of projects, but the one that has kind of captured a lot of attention and been a place for us to kind of be seen is Service Center, and that's at 3819 Lafayette Road out in front of Lafayette Square Mall. So basically it's a place where we can open up the doors for people in the community to do events, and that could include arts people, but also people who are trying to do things like a project that went on this year called Innovate Indy, that where people met with great ideas for the city.
Right, right.
And that happened there throughout the year this year. We finished our first year in May. We had nearly 10,000 people in throughout that year, which is 10,000 more than they had the year before because it was empty and
right.
No one was in there at all. So it's a place for creativity, community, and culture to come together.
And it was actually an old service center, and it's sort of in an area that was really underserved by not just cultural organizations, but even by any public space, I mean libraries or anything like that out at 38th and Lafayette.
Yeah, that's kind of a dead zone there in terms of that. There's a lot of commercial that has come and gone and changed, and some of the changes have been sort of out of necessity in a good way, where you have a lot of international restaurants and independent family-owned businesses there. Places like King Wok that I eat almost every day. That's Vietnamese. It's amazing. Yeah, in terms of a place for people to meet, the neighborhood meetings used to be like in a back room in a car dealership or something like that. And so this is a little more friendly and visible, where there are resources there that are all kind of creativity and cultural based. And it's also a highly visible, I mean, the biggest part of what people see when they look at the building is this big garden that we have out in front. That's surviving in the heat out
Good
on the parking lot. And
all container gardens. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Above, kind of on top of the asphalt in boxes that were built during Lily Day of Service last year. And so there's tomatoes, sunflowers, sweet potatoes, cucumbers, all that stuff is, and it's sprouted up and it looks really nice. And there are benches and places for people to sit, and we're adding more things. And one thing that's been a big attraction are the chickens. So we have three chickens out there
nice.
In a little coop.
Right.
So Naptown Chickens is a kind of newer operation around town that is providing these portable chicken coops to nonprofits and schools. And people come from all over to check out the chickens and feed them or just look at what's going on.
You mentioned Big Car, and I just want to be clear about this, because I know there's a little confusion, because Big Car had a gallery downtown Square. There is no longer a Big Car gallery, but Big Car exists as a not-for-profit that does a lot of work, and Service Center is part of that. Is that correct,
right,
basically?
Right. Yes, that's it. So Big Car, sort of an overarching nonprofit that's really determined to use what we can do, which is creativity-based, cultural-based, arts-based stuff, to help make the city better. So when there's opportunities like Service Center to come into a neighborhood and make a difference there, that's one of the projects that we do, but we do a variety of other things around the city too.
So let's talk about some of the stuff coming up. And there are a lot of things. The one that I'm actually, I think, the most intrigued about is Fishtails. And that's because I'm a fisherman. And so my understanding is with Fishtails, it's photographs of people fishing on the White River. Is that right?
Yeah, this is a partnership with the Indianapolis Arts Center, and it opens on August the 3rd as part of their big event that they have that night. And what we have been doing is a few different people who are part of the group. So Big Car is a nonprofit organization, but also has a collective of artists who are participating in this.
Sure.
And so several photographers, Craig McCormick and Jeremy Ephraimson are both two who've shown a lot. And there are some others who are participating, including myself. And we have been going around and just taking pictures along the White River, finding fishermen, talking to them, and just kind of documenting this. You know, we might see them out there. We don't know who they are, so we're kind of talking to them a little bit, finding out who they are and asking them for what they catch. And, you know, just like you do if, you know, you go out and you go walking down to go find a place to fish, there's going to be another couple people there maybe, and you're going to say, how's it going? You got anything today? And they're like, oh, no, this is, you know, or they might say, this is what's working or this is what's not working. Or
I always thought you have to be pretty dedicated to fishing if you're going to fish the White River. But, you know, you always see, I mean, you know, people fishing for catfish sort of down closer downtown. But also I know that there is some decent fly fishing up like near the Arts Center and stuff. I mean, did you talk to a variety of fishermen? Or
yeah, different ones who are – we talk to carp fishermen. We see people down by the dam that's just near 16th Street.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a whole variety, and when I talk to some of the guys who are out there, they're talking about catching smallmouth bass in different parts of the White River.
Yeah.
You know, so it's turned around, and I think, I mean, part of the project for us is really the social aspect of just talking to people, and so, you know, versus just taking pictures of the river, it's kind of getting us out and kind of meeting who the fishermen and finding out who they are.
That's very cool. So I'm looking forward to that. So that opens at the Arts Center on August 3rd.
Yeah, and that's part of the White River Festival, which is in its second year. It started last year. It's mostly in September, but there's a little bit of activity in August and October. And the Upper White River Watershed Alliance is the organization that's kind of behind that with several partners. And then there would be a whole host of events that happen in the month of September.
Cool. So 48-Hour Film Festival is something else that is coming up super soon. And this is a cool event, annual event each summer. Basically, filmmakers register, and they're sort of given some very specific parameters where they have to shoot and edit and produce a film in 48 hours to compete. Is that
kind of... That's correct.
Yeah. So what's going on this year? I know people can still register and stuff.
Yeah, we've moved it was a little bit earlier. We've moved it back to the same weekend. So the Friday night that the show opens at the Arts Center, the 3rd, is also the launch of the 48-Hour Film Project. So people come that night, they get their genre, they draw it that night, and then there are some other things like a line of dialogue and a prop and a character that they don't know about. So last year, the line of dialogue was, I would prefer not to. So every movie has to say... they're all in the 7-minute range, the movies. So every one of them has to say, I would prefer not to, somewhere in there. And then there's like a dentist or a lawyer or something like that that you have to have in your movie. And then some prop. So last year it was an orange.
But it's all surprise. So that night
they don't know until they draw. Mm-hmm. And that keeps them from making their movie ahead of time. So they go and they start from scratch. And a lot of times people work from those things. Mm-hmm. So the prop in one year was a helmet. So there were all kinds of crazy short films that involved helmets.
Right. I remember one with a tinfoil helmet protecting a woman from alien beams from outer space.
Yeah, it was shot at the Chatterbox. You were probably hanging out down there, weren't you?
Yes, it was.
So they, so that's kind of how they do it. And last year we had around 40 teams.
That's really
cool. Together films. And
so professionals, amateurs, I mean...
Anybody. And sometimes it's the better ones or just as good are more amateur because they're having a good time and the story is what really makes the difference.
Yeah.
So when I talk to the filmmakers, a lot of times that's what I say is, you know, a good story and energy and sort of a positivity that comes out of the film is really what makes it click and...
If someone wants to register or get more information about how to do that, where should they go?
48hourfilm.com.
Very cool. So tell me about some of the other things you've got going on. I know that there is a show at the Service Center coming up dealing with place, right?
Yeah, this one is a skate...
The skateboard show.
Right. Yep, and it's called Place Mentality. So it's an all-day sort of way for the skateboard community. And there's a gentleman named Mike Block that came to us and wanted to do this. And so they're going to have skateboarding conversations, a show, music, actual skateboarding happening with ramps and, you know, jumps and all the stuff they do.
Cool.
Because one of the things about Service Center is we have that big garage.
Yeah, and you've got a big parking lot.
And we have a big parking lot. So there's all kinds of room. And they're going to do that in and out of the garden and have food and, you know, just all kinds of things. And just a sort of a celebration of skateboarding and
nice.
Taking and over the space.
And when is that one coming up?
That's on the 4th. So that's August the 4th.
Okay. So before we went on the air, we were talking a little bit about TED. What is TED? Who is TED? What's all up with TED?
Well, there's this... It's not the bear that's in all the commercials
right.
that are out in the movie.
yeah, I didn't think so.
There was it's around since the 80s, an organization based out of New York, that the initials for it are TED, but what they started out to do are these conferences and so just furthering these ideas of technology, entertainment, and design.
Okay.
And so they have two big conferences, and a lot of videos are produced out of these two conferences. And they also have city versions of those that are called TEDxs. And people make videos of presentations there. So people who are leaders in technology, leaders in design, leaders in education, leaders in a variety of other subjects that have sort of come out of that, they do kind of like a PowerPoint presentation, but in a very much more entertaining than sitting through a boring PowerPoint.
Okay.
And then those get recorded and they get shared on the internet. So this has really taken off since the internet, and they have an app, and so people watch these, millions of people watch these videos.
Now this is different from the PowerPoint competitions, the
Pachachka.
Yes.
It's kind of has some things in common with Pachachka.
Okay.
But these are not. There's no competition. People are selected to present. Very notable people present at the national conferences. People like Al Gore will present at these conferences. And the idea is that, you know, to put out these really good ideas, ideas worth sharing is what they're talking about. So people, sometimes it's revealing like amazing new technologies. Sometimes it's stories, health stories. Sometimes it's about design, how design's helping a city in, some part of the world. So we are kind of teaming up with the International School of Indiana and the IMA to bring one of these local versions of this conference here to the IMA.
Okay.
And that's October the 26th.
Very cool. So definitely be looking for more information on that as we get closer to that.
Yeah, the theme of this one is not entertainment or design specifically only. It's education and design. So design learning is what we're talking about with this one.
So last thing I want to ask you about, another thing that Big Car is involved with, doing some work with the Idle Jorg and the Indiana State Museum. What's going on with that?
Well, we started a thing called the Department of Yes. We really felt like what we were about is saying yes to opportunities for people to have fun and to kind of invigorate public spaces that are maybe there but aren't being activated in a way they could be.
Yeah.
So...
Or yes.
We're focusing on White River State Park this year, and have partnered with the State Museum and with the Idle Jorg, sort of pair up some games that could be played on the lawn that's out in front of both of those.
Sure. Yeah, those are
places.
Great lawns and really kind of underutilized.
Yeah, and there's a lot of opportunities for things to happen there. And then also they have the canal and the cultural trail right around them too.
Mm-hmm.
So there's foot traffic, there's space. And we just feel like there's just this missing ingredient of outdoor activities. And so both of the museums are bringing staff out to have activities going on, and then we're bringing games out and activities that'll be matched up. So
like what, cornhole, croquet?
No, I mean
frisbee,
like kite flying.
Kite flying, okay.
big games with like this earth ball, like a giant ball that people can play with. We did some of this stuff at the Super Bowl on the Super Bowl Village down on the they put that little football field out there in front of the convention center, and so we had people playing zombie tag, and you know, where if you're a zombie you can't run, and so you just kind of chase people, and you know, that's the kind of stuff that's going to be out there, just
fun.
Grabbing people and saying, hey, you want to get involved and do something fun.
Any kite making workshops on the horizon?
That's part of the project out there, and then we're looking at doing a big kite festival, or at least a day-long kite event. A gentleman, Clayton Hamilton, is a guy who does – he's kind of known for the sign that he makes on 38th and College. He did a mural on our building, and we got to become friends with him, and it turns out he's really into kites. And so we're looking at finding the right spot for it and having a kite building and then a big day where people are flying tons of kites.
Let me know, because I actually have many, many, many kites myself, some I own, some I've built, and would love to be a part of that. That sounds cool.
Yeah, sure. Have you ever seen the little tiny kites?
I've got, like even just like a few inches.
Yeah.
Like really small
ones.
Yeah,
that's what I think would be really neat to do for the workshop. And that's what we may try to do down at the State Museum, is build these little, very small kites. And then have those kind of flying around,
and it's a great way to explore different reuses of materials too. I mean, you can make a kite out of, grocery bags, whether the paper ones or the plastic ones.
Yeah.
And there's lots of different, you know, fun things you can do with that.
Yeah, and it'd be neat to see them all up in the sky.
Yeah.
And the thematic link is the projects they're doing based on birds.
Okay.
And so we were thinking about having kites that look like birds and having people make their own sort of. And I think that would help you learn a lot about how birds work, you know, because they have to have that loft and the lightness to make it work.
Exactly.
And I think a kite and a bird, you know, obviously have a lot in common. So that's one of the things we want to do.
Well, cool. Well, let me know. And again, let's continue to keep in touch. Jim, it's always a pleasure to find out what's going on with you guys.
Thanks, Travis.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with community artist advocate Jim Walker. You can find out more about everything Big Car at... you guessed it, bigcar.org, bigcar.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I'll talk with Lou Harry about a project coming up this fall in Chicago.
Very cool. I'll chat with playwright Rita Kahn about a new work that she's created for this year's State Fair.
Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.